Welcome everyone to We Can Shine. Here on our show, we shine a light on the Vietnamese community in Canada and beyond to inform, connect, and inspire. We invite you to listen to the stories and conversations about current events, issues affecting our community, the world, the arts, and just life in general. On today's show, we're going to be discussing real estate and investment with Andy Pham, who works in commercial mortgages and asset management, and Edward Goodwill, who is an investment advisor. They're going to be giving us a rundown of some basic concepts and also some tips on investing. Today's episode is a little different than normal, as it's going to be all in English. So without further ado, let's go over to Andy and Edward.
Hi, everybody. My name is Andy Pham, and this is my good friend, Edward Goodwill. Edward, do you want to go by Edward or do you want to go by Eddie?
You know, my mom calls me Edward, but my friends call me Eddie.
Okay, perfect. Perfect. Okay, so we're going to talk about two broad general topics here. One is real estate for the retail investor, and the other one, Eddie, is going to be
on the investment side of things, because I'm an investment advisor. I manage people's money and help them reach their goals. And so I can bring that side of the conversation to you today.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's going to be quite exciting. And I'm a real estate guy. I work for a large real estate firm. We do a bunch of stuff related to real estate, all sorts of stuff, actually. So you can say I'm real estate and he's like equities.
That's probably a good way to put it.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. But we're gonna talk from what the retail investor perspective. So I know what that means, but Eddie, what do you say to your client when they say, "What's a retail investor?"
Good question. A retail investor is somebody who's not like an institution. You know, there's pension funds and there's, you know, big sort of entities that will invest money, like the Canadian Pension Plan. A retail investor is someone like you and me that invests our own money because we want to do it ourselves. So that's probably the simplest way to put it.
Okay. Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking. So even though we both work for a large institutional money, we're not going to talk about investing from a large institutional money's point of view. It's from everyday people, you and me. We made our money, we saved our money, and we're going to try and invest it in the best possible way we know how, given what we know, and or maybe given what we don't know too, right?
Yeah, well, that's a huge thing in this business, whether it's real estate or equities or any asset class. There's so much that we do not know. So in many ways, we have to be comfortable with the unknown. Otherwise, you'll never start. So that's probably point number one, is be comfortable being uncomfortable.
Well, exactly. Sometimes, you know, I just say, you know what? I don't know everything, but I got to make a decision. Because if I don't make a decision, then it might not work out too good for me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, just own up to it. So I mean when we think about investing in real estate, Okay. I mean realistically, what can we buy? Like a single family house, you know, maybe cut it up and, well, not cut it up, but you know, hopefully it has potential for a bunch of suites, right? Rent those out, or you buy a condo, right? So basically, as a retail investor, you know, smallish with, like, you know, not millions or billions of dollars to invest in. That's what we're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And there's, you know, lots of different types, from single family homes or, you know, a duplex or a condo or a townhouse, which I live in, you know, so lots of different options for investing in direct real estate.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. So this is direct real estate, getting into it and actually owning it. So let's talk about investing in stocks. So most people understand investing in real estate, homes and condos, whatever, but real estate stocks. What are we getting when we're like buying a stock? A stock of what?
Good question. I ask myself this every day, you know? So I think, you know, one of the ways to characterize buying a stock, you know, of a company, let's say, you know, TELUS or Apple, you know, we all of us should be familiar with those two companies. When you buy a stock, you're essentially buying a share of that business. You know, and to simplify it, you could say Andy's got Andy's pizzeria and it's worth, you know, $100,000, this really great pizzeria, and he wants to, you know, bring in an investor. And so he might want to sell me some of his stock. In other words, it's called an equity in his business. So that's why we call stocks equities and equity stocks. And he's basically selling me a share of his business at a certain price. And if I choose to buy it, then I actually have ownership on future profits of that business. So when we buy a stock on the public stock market, whether it's the Toronto Stock Exchange or the S&P 500 in the US, you're basically just paying for a share of a business. And that's that means you have exposure to its future profits. And so that's really the simplest way to explain what ownership of a stock is. So okay. There's a lot more I can talk about, but I'll stop there.
No, I think that's exactly it. I mean, okay, so Andy's Pizzeria, you know, let's say the worth of my business is $100. Okay, let's just keep all the math super, super simple, right? $100 is the value of my business. So if I create, right, through the magic of legal work and you know, paper and computers and whatever, create 100 shares. So each share would be worth $1, right?
Yeah.
And so then if the pizza company makes $100 in profits, let's say, so for simplicity's sake, then I have ownership of $1. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you're saying there's, you know, your pizza company sells, let's say you sell $100 worth of pizza.
Yeah.
Net income is $1.
Yeah.
So that's a small margin. Let's say your net income is $10.
Okay, fine.
$100 of pizzas. So you make a 10% profit margin. Now let's not get worried about the terms, but profit margin is your sort of cash in the bank after you've paid for all the expenses. And so if I own one share of the 100 shares that we discussed, I have 1% of that $10 profit, not just for that year, but I get that, 1% of all future profits. Now, I bought the share of Andy's business because I think he's going to do so well that he's going to 10x his business and he's going to sell $1,000 worth of pizza, and he's going to make $100 of net profit. And so my 1% of that $100 is now $1. I paid 10 cents for it, you know, so I've 10x'd my investment because I've bought a share in Andy's amazingly tasty pizza business. And so that's basically it. You get the upside of his success in his pizza business.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. So let's keep in mind that when you buy a share of the company, you are entitled to that net income that they make.
Yes.
Okay. So that's the idea behind it. So how good the company is, how strong the company is, will determine your earnings in the future.
Exactly. And future success. And I always, I grew up reading about Warren Buffett and how he approaches investing. I encourage everybody listening to this to go Google the guy. He's one of the best investors to have ever lived. And what the way he invests is it, with a very, very long-term view. And his first goal, apart from, you know, buying a company for a good price, he's more interested in who the owners and who the managers of that business are. So in this case, I really trust that Andy's going to have the best pizzeria in all of Vancouver. And I know it's going to grow. And under his guidance, I'm just an owner. You know, I've got that one share. I'm just going to be an owner and I'm going to let Andy do all the work. And I have confidence in him. He's going to make a lot of money. I'm going to make a lot of money. And, but it's Andy, he, you know, my investment success will rely on Andy's performance as a manager of the business.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. And I love pizza. Pizza's great. Thank you so much. Okay. So,
let's move over. Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And I'm so happy that you have so much faith in my pizza making abilities, more than mine.
Absolutely. So, Andy, why don't you sort of make the comparison to that in the real estate
environment, So in the real estate environment, when you're buying, let's say you're buying into a condo, okay, you want to buy a condo, what's the money that you're going to make when you buy a condo? Well, you're going to make rent, right? Buy a condo in a certain area, you figure out how much rent can you get per month, calculate, you know, times 12, how much rent are you going to make on a yearly basis? But when you're buying a condo, at least for me, I'm not going to be buying it on cash, right? So I'm going to be borrowing money to buy the condo. So the borrowing is going to come with its own expenses, paying the mortgage, right? Mm-hmm. Now, we know that a part of that goes towards paying down the principal on my loan, and a part of that pays for the interest. But the mortgage, the monthly mortgage, is my expense for the condo. Let's just keep it simple, right? But what else do I have to consider before I can actually, you know, earn my net income? And when I say net income, it's net of expenses, right? So what am I paying for? I'm paying for my mortgage, right? What else am I paying for? Well, I'm paying for my condo fees, right? So what else am I paying for? I'm paying for my property taxes, okay? What else am I paying for? Well, if I'm buying a new condo, maybe I don't have to think about fixing things here and there, right? So maybe I can hold out on paying any maintenance on my condo. But if I'm paying, if I'm buying an older condo, maybe something's going to come up and I'm going to be paying for it, okay? So let's just say general maintenance expenses, right? What else am I paying for? I'm paying for, if I am not going to get my own renters, if I am going to hire someone else to get renters for me, that will cost me money because no one's going to work for free, right? So you pay some money to some sort of person or a management company to get you the renters. Okay, great. So you can do that and they can pay you. They can get the renters for you, or you can do that yourself. But that is something that could be an expense. What else am I paying for? Oh, yeah. Just in case something bad happens, you pay for insurance. Okay. Yeah. So I've just listed a whole bunch of things that you're paying for that you subtract away from your rental income, and that gives you your net income. So when you think about what you're making when you are investing in real estate, don't think about the rent that you can get from that condo or that house or whatever. Think about what you actually net after expenses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's and the math is really simple. You take whatever, you start subtracting away, and that's how much money you make at the end of a month. Or maybe you think about it on a yearly basis, because most of the times we think about this from a yearly basis. So on an annual basis, what are you netting in terms of of a rent, yeah. Right? So that's generally how the cash is made in a real estate investment from like, you know, a yearly operational basis. Now we maybe will touch upon the idea of like tax benefits, and maybe we'll touch upon the ideas of appreciation, because appreciation ties into buying of stocks, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So whether you're buying a piece of real estate that you rent out and you have expenses that gets you your net income, that's just cash flow. And you know, you can buy a stock. I can buy the stock in Andy's Pizzeria and he's giving me, he's earning $10 in cash flow. Now there's something that's really important with both real estate and stocks or businesses is traditionally they grow over time. And so a lot of the return or your future wealth creation comes from the appreciation in price of the real estate. Generally, real estate goes up with inflation. We all live in Vancouver, so we're used to the idea that real estate goes up, quite a bit faster than inflation. I don't know if it can continue. That's not my place to try to predict. And you know, same with the stock market. Over time, the stock market has returned, on average, about 8 to 10% per year, and 2% of that return is the cash flow. And so there's two big components, either in real estate or in the stock market. It's the, you know, it's the income that you're earning plus the future growth of the price of the business itself or the real estate itself.
Right. Yeah, totally. And now one thing that we've noticed in Vancouver is real estate prices have appeared to just kept on growing for the last, 20 years. You know, if you just look at the charts, right? If you look at the charts, generally speaking, it's always gone up. Okay. Which is why people, I would say, in the city love real estate. Like they love to talk about real estate, which happens a lot. I mean, I work in it, so of course I talk about real estate. But people who don't work in it also love to talk about real estate because, I mean, you know, I mean, your house just like doubled in value or something in like 5 years or something like that. Of course, you're gonna talk about it because you like to brag about it and whatnot. You like to, you know, like to make yourself feel good that this is a great investment and look how smart I am. Yeah. But that does play into the idea that real estate makes a good investment, and indeed it does. If you kind of get into it as an investment, you got to think, okay, so maybe over time it's going to increase in value, right? Mm-hmm. But what's causing it to increase in value? Okay, well, one part of it could be the cash flow that it makes could increase over time. I mean, rents do increase over time. Mm-hmm. But the other part of it is people just notice a natural price appreciation in real estate. And then people might expect that to keep on continuing. And that in itself causes the psychological view that real estate will keep on increasing.
Yeah. I think generally real estate goes up for, you know, a couple of reasons. One is population growth. So location is super important. You know, if you've got a piece of real estate up in, you know, Northern Alaska, there might not be a lot of appreciation there because I don't know how many people, you know, move to Alaska every year. You know, maybe you can correct me on this, but I don't think very many. But a place like Vancouver, you know, there's a lot of people, whether it's foreign buyers, we've all heard about that, or whether it's, you know, retirees out of Ontario that are interprovincial, you know, traveling to retire on the coast, that's population growth. Plus, Canada has a mandate to bring in, I think, 400 or 500,000 immigrants every year. So naturally, prices sort of trend upwards, you know, given, you know, the fact that we can't build 500,000 houses a year. So, you know, what happens is there's more demand than supply. And generally, the economy has to be doing somewhat well for people to want to move here and earn a living and do well in the economy. And so, you know, over time, those sorts of factors can lead to real estate appreciation in the price, simply because of there's a little bit more demand than supply. But generally, you know, my rule of thumb is over a long period of time, you can expect real estate to grow with inflation. So when markets go up more than that, you know, it might be worth it to be a little bit cautious. Make sure you pay attention to what you're buying. Yeah.
Right.
So,
I totally agree. But you still have to think about the cash flow. You still have to think about like, you know, I always say cash is king, you know, watch your cash flow, you know, blah, blah, blah. But really, if you're going to buy a condo or any type of real estate as a retail investor, are you going to be able to pay yourself something, hopefully, after you do your simple, take your rent you're earning on a yearly basis, subtract away all your expenses, right? Are you going to be paying yourself something, or are you going to be putting money in because you're short? Okay. So if you're short, I don't know if that is a good investment for you right now. I'm assuming also that, let's say, on $1 million condo, right? Let's say you buy $1 million condo to invest, then you're putting $250,000 down, right? 25% on $1 million condo. Are you making enough on a yearly basis to make it worth your while to be a landlord, to invest in this condo? Or maybe you found only something that's $500,000. Okay, fine, $500,000 purchase of a condo. You're still putting in $125,000 down. So if you do the math, is that worth you having this right now? Now, some people might think, oh yeah, it's going to go up. Like, it's always going to go up. So I'm going to keep it. But how long can you sustain this negative cash flow? How long you got to put money into this real estate investment, so-called investment?
Yeah, well, that's why it's so important to take your time when you're looking at an investment, whether it's a stock or real estate. Both are applicable. But basically, you want to be buying an asset. Let's just focus on real estate that you are pretty darn sure you're not going to be in a negative cash flow position. So you've looked at the market. Maybe it's in Vancouver, rent is $3,000 a month or $4,000 a month, and your mortgage cost is only $2,500. You might have a strata insurance and other gas fees or whatever for $500. So that gets you to $3,000 of expenses. You know, so there's $1,000 of profit. And as long as you're sure that there's not some massive assessment coming on your condo building for $100,000 that you're going to have to pony up for, to me, you know, you're in $1,000 of positive cash flow, which, you know, I mentioned this before, Andy, is this book that I read when I was a kid. It's called Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. Everybody should read this book. My dad gave me this book when I was like 12 or 13 years old, and he gave me a $50 bill and he cut it in half. He said, Eddie, you can use half of the 50 as a bookmark. And when you finish the book, I'll give you the other 50 bucks, tape it together, and then you can spend it. So it convinced me to read the book. But basically, the idea of the book is this guy tells you through a really well-written story, so it's not a difficult read, it's really easy to read, is how to start thinking about making your money work for you. So finding ways to invest in things like real estate where you're going to be net positive after the mortgage, after the expenses, after the property tax, And then what you can do with that extra cash flow, don't go and spend it. I mean, spend a little bit of it, but what you could do with it is figure out how you can use that extra cash flow to go buy something else that cash flows. And it creates this amazing snowball effect, which you can, again, it's you go to sleep at night and your money is still working for you. So highly encourage you to read that book.
That's the allure of investing. When it comes to when it comes to stocks, when it comes to equities, Eddie, is there any cash that comes back to you?
So, good question, because I could go into the complicated way of trying to
describe. Maybe on another show, but let's keep it simple.
I'll try to keep it simple. Okay, so everybody knows the company Apple. Lots of people have the iPhones and stuff like that. I'm just going to look it up on my computer here. So Apple pays a dividend of about 2.5%.
Okay, let's define that dividend.
So, yeah, dividend. So Apple has earned enough money every year. You know, they make about 10%, you know, on their revenue. So their net income is 10%. So they have 10% of extra cash lying around at the end of every year. And the manager of Apple has a choice. Either take all that $10 and reinvest it in the growth of the business, you know, make the pizzeria bigger. But he might
make the Apple bigger this time.
Yeah, make Apple bigger. Yeah, make the Apple bigger, exactly. But, you know, Tim Cook, he's the CEO of Apple. He's decided, well, there aren't enough growth opportunities to spend all the $10, but we want to reward the people that own our stock, the shareholders, with a dividend. A dividend is a payment from the company, which is a cash payment to the people that own each share of Apple. So if you bought $100 worth of Apple, you'll get $2.50 sent to you every year from Apple. So that's what a dividend is. You have to look at all of these opportunities with two sorts of lenses. One is, do I think there's going to be some price appreciation in the investment? But am I also going to earn some cash along the way, get some cash? You know, I call it being paid to wait. You know, you can build up your own security buffers by putting some cash in the bank. And so that's important to think about when you are buying a stock, you know, not just real estate. You want to be
when you say getting paid to wait. Okay. Now let me just clarify right here. We're not talking about buying a stock or buying real estate and then just selling it. We're talking about us trying to figure out if this is a long-term worthy place to invest in. This stock or this piece of real estate, okay? Because you can buy in it, you can sell out, you can buy in, you can sell out, you can make whatever market gains you can, but this is not what we're focusing on today. Mm-hmm. Being paid to wait. Okay, so that means that for a stock, right? If you buy into a good company that pays you a good dividend, then it's giving you a cash flow that's not costing you anything, not costing you any effort, but you're getting that paid to you, let's say every year, right? Mm-hmm. You're holding that company. And then over time, you believe this business is good enough and it's going to be worth more in the future and your shares are going to be worth more in the future, right? Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to equate that to real estate. So you buy into real estate now, and you have the money, you put it down, you buy $1 million real estate, and you do your math and your cash flow works out positive. Okay, so you don't have any money coming out of your pocket. So after you continue that for, you know, X number of years, and you're hoping through general inflation, price appreciation, you're getting your piece of real estate is going to be worth more, that both instances are getting paid to wait.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the big expenses in all of our lives is taxes. It's the second largest expense that any of us here listening will pay in our entire life. And that's through income tax and other forms. But when you sell an investment for a gain, you're going to pay tax on it. Now, why would you sell an investment that's giving you positive cash flow and you think it's going to keep going up? The whole idea with building, you know, a long-term nest egg is to own things that, and you treat it like you're an owner of the business and you own the real estate. Why, you know, if it's a good investment, you should just keep owning it for as long as you can, because you defer otherwise taxes that would be payable on sale. And it's one of the reasons why Warren Buffett is so rich, is when he buys a company, he bought Coca-Cola in the 1970s, he still owns it. And if he paid that, if he sold Coca-Cola, he would have been, he'd be way less rich, because he would have paid, you know, billions of dollars of taxes. So he gets to compound his net worth in a fabulous company. We can all debate, you know, sugar products or whatever, but it is a good company that creates a lot of cash flow for him. And he doesn't have to pay any tax on sales because he's not going to sell it. And same with real estate. If you find a property in a location that's amazing and there's going to be tons of population growth, you should just keep owning it. Eventually you'll pay off your mortgage and you'll have all this equity.
Yeah.
You'll be able to use that equity to go and buy some new property in a new location that's going to do the same thing. And you just rinse and repeat.
That's right. That's right. And in the case of real estate, this is probably for another show, but in the case of real estate, you can borrow that money that's held, the equity in your real estate, for further investments should you choose.
Yeah.
Right. So that is an option. Now, since you brought up taxes, now I have to talk about the tax treatment that you really have to consider between dividends and rental income. Mm-hmm. So I'll just talk about the tax treatment on rental income. All the rental income that you make is added to your net income in your taxes, and it's taxed at whatever tax rate that you pay. So it goes straight there. And just remember that the tax rate that you pay on your salary income is the worst possible tax regime possible, right? Is that true, Eddie?
Yeah, well, I mean, depends on who you support in Ottawa.
Okay.
But
okay,
we won't get into politics. But yes, when you earn income personally, that's like, you know, that's, you get sort of taxed at the highest rate, you know, and you keep, let's say you make $210,000 of, you know, you've got your personal salary, you've got other real estate. If you get to that level, you're going to pay 52 cents in tax for every dollar that you earn. So more of it's going away to Ottawa than you get to keep in your pocket. When you have a dividend, you get taxed 15%. So it's actually a favorable tax regime when you, because the government wants people to invest. So it's a way of stimulating, you know, the flow of money and savings and investments. So the average tax rate on a dividend in Canada, at least, is about 15%. So it's not so punitive, but you do get taxed on it when you.
Yeah, you know, that is something that I think about when I look at, you know, buying a condo for like quote unquote investment purposes, because I mean at the end of the year, let's say I do eke out and I net out, oh, let's say $5,000, right? Let's say I net out $5,000 in rent, you know, after I subtract all my expenses. And then I would effectively add that to my income and put on my taxes. And then, you know, depending on my marginal tax rate, I would pay taxes on that $5,000. Yeah. So that's something to think about. But the one thing about real estate that, you know, you with regards to taxes is, okay, so hopefully you're not losing money every year, but if you lose money, that does decrease your income, and that could lower your income taxes, right? But you don't want to be like losing money on your real estate investment every year. Another thing about real estate is you can write off the capital gains on the real estate itself, and that serves to decrease the amount of taxes that you pay every year. So that is another benefit of owning real estate, is through the capital cost allowance, the depreciation of the asset. But mind you, that's not like a freebie. If you sell the real estate, then you add all that accumulated depreciation back and you pay taxes on that.
And one more point on that is there's a thing called depreciation for a reason. Means that you own a house for long enough, you're going to have to, it depreciates, the roof falls apart, stuff happens. So the more, if you have depreciation and it lowers your taxable income, that kind of just means that, you know, down the road, you will have to prepare yourself for spending some money to upgrade it again, to get it up to snuff. So it's not a free lunch. There's no such thing as a free lunch.
No,
no matter where you go, Andy, nothing is free.
You're so exactly right on that. Because if you own a condo, okay, and you're writing off that depreciation every year and you think this is great, I get this like tax benefit effectively from writing off this appreciation, and then you hit with like a special assessment.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of like the money that you've saved from your, you know, written off depreciation that you just put back into your investment.
Yeah. And
that's what it compensates for.
Yeah. Just to round out the taxes before, you know, everybody falls asleep.
Yeah, I know, right? But it is important, okay? The tax treatment is very important.
But yeah, like I said, it's the second biggest expense other than our lifestyle spending that we'll ever have in our entire lives. So on real estate, I think, you know, some people will be familiar with, at least on your principal residence, you get the principal residence exemption. So if you do need to sell your house, it is tax-free only on your primary residence. Your rental properties, if you are renting properties for cash flow, that's considered differently by the tax authorities, and you will be taxed on that. But your primary residence, if you sell it, at least in BC, that's tax-free.
Right. Yeah, no. Okay. Is that the last thing we're going to say about taxes?
Yeah, let's stop.
For now? There. Okay, let's stop. I'll talk about tax, but it is a very important thing, okay? So
we can do another one on taxes if the listeners comment and say, hey, we want Andy and Eddie to talk about taxes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Please don't ask us to talk about taxes.
Yeah.
Okay, let's touch quickly on what makes a good stock to buy. And of course we'll talk about what makes like good real estate to buy.
Yeah.
What makes a good stock to buy?
So that's another great question because there's so many different answers.
That's right.
There's a difference between good and ethical. So, a good stock to buy, you know, might very well be a tobacco stock. But the problem with tobacco stocks is they're not so good for your health. So, you know, you can earn a lot of profits owning a booze company or a tobacco company or an oil company, but you have to be careful in case you don't align with those types of ethics. You have to understand what you're buying, so you're not, you know, supporting an industry that you really dislike, even though the profits might be good.
Well, let's go then into that a little bit deeper than that, okay? And I was just thinking about the tobacco industry. So what makes the tobacco industry a good stock to buy, not an ethical stock to buy, but just for a money making perspective, because you want the best bang for your buck. What is it about tobacco?
Yeah. Okay. So tobacco, it's been around for, I don't know, hundreds of years. I don't know.
Yeah.
Who started smoking it or figured out that the humans liked to inhale things, but for some reason we do. And for many, many years in the sort of 20th century, it became very popularized through marketing. And, you know, basically in tobacco, there's a drug called nicotine that gets people addicted. And so once you start smoking, it's very, very difficult to stop. And the advertising agencies caught on to this. Whoa, this how can we prey on addiction and make money? And so what they did is they started telling people that smoking is great, smoking is cool, and they got America hooked on smoking. And so there's this massive population, not just in America, but all around the world, that is completely addicted to smoking. And without proper education, there's always going to be a huge proportion of human beings that find their way into smoking, and they're never going to stop. So why is this good from a financial perspective? As a company, you have an assured amount of demand from customers, and it's never going to go away. So when you start a business like Andy's Pizzeria, I don't know if everybody's going to go to Andy's Pizzeria. You know, maybe they're not going to. But if I knew for 100% fact that Andy's going to have a steady flow of customers, well, I really want to buy his company now, because I know he's going to generate profits. Because you might have a good product, but you need to have the customers.
That's right. Yeah. I get that. So, smoking is addictive. The customers will come back often and repeatedly, and they'll keep buying your products because they are hooked. In this case, they are physically, psychologically hooked to your product, which means that as long as you keep your, as long as the company keeps their expenses low, and we all know it's cheap to make cigarettes. And they sell it at a reasonably strong high margin. So they make money off every single packet of cigarette. The company will make money over the long, long run. And yes, some companies have made money for well over 100 years selling a highly addictive product.
Yeah.
And that makes it a good investment. Yeah.
Absolutely. So that from a financial perspective makes it a good investment.
Okay. From an ethical perspective,
maybe not. You might love tobacco, whatever, but a lot of people might disagree with it and the effects on the health of our population. So
but you know, there are other companies that make things that are pretty necessary, I would say, these days. And it's not like physiologically debilitating to you and not going to make you get lung cancer and, you know, die one day, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, there's tons of examples. The thing with the stock market is it's so deep that it can be daunting, but there's, you know, hundreds and thousands of different companies that you can invest in, really, which is part of the scary part about investing. Cause you have to be aware of all of these companies in a way and make sure you're not picking the wrong one. So we can get into alternatives to buying single stocks a little bit later. But like, for instance, the banks, Bank of Nova Scotia, TD Bank, Royal Bank, those are critical institutions for the economy, for all of us, everyday banking, checking, debit, whatever. And so you can argue whether a bank is ethical or not, but from my perspective, I think they're crucial to what we do.
At least the banks won't give you lung cancer.
Yeah, they won't. They might give you a lot of emotional stress, you know, waiting at that 20-minute lineup in the till. But anyway, so there's an example of a business that is indispensable, really, for the economy. And so, you know, I won't get into, you know, all the numbers about it, but banks are indispensable and they won't be going anywhere anytime soon. And
they have been around for a few hundred years too.
Yeah, there's always banking. You know, you could argue that crypto might, you know, dislodge the banks, but what's probably going to happen is the banks will just consume the crypto market in a way. They're, you know, don't bet against the banks. They are very good at adapting to the environment as well. And so you could buy a bank because they're always going to have customers. You know, when immigrants come in, they need to open a checking account. They need a bank account to show for insurance documents. There's so many reasons why people need a bank. And so you've got that natural demand. So there's...
I have to say kind of like when you start smoking, you can't give it up. You know, when you open a bank account at a certain bank, I don't think you're going to close that bank account. Like you are there.
Absolutely.
And you almost for life.
You know what I say, Andy? If you're going to be a client of the bank, you might as well own the bank.
Yep.
Because you're paying, you might as well own, you're paying monthly fees and all that. So you might as well own a share of it. Not a recommendation, but you know, banks can be.
No, I totally agree, Eddie. I mean, you should think about how good a business this is.
Yeah.
And if it's that good, you should get a piece of it.
Yeah. And then there's a whole bunch of other factors. Again, I go back to Warren Buffett, and, you know, he invests in companies that have a strong brand like Coca-Cola or Geico, the insurer. So a strong brand, meaning competitors won't make them, you know, go bankrupt if they enter the market. Strong brand, good management team in a sector like banking or whatever that has a lot of tailwinds to it. You don't want to buy, you know, small companies that have a rocky road ahead of them. You want to buy established businesses that have good financial metrics, a good team, a good moat, you know, a brand around them. And that's sort of where to start when you're looking at companies or stocks to buy.
Perfect. Okay. You know what?
Switch to the real estate side.
I don't know if I can cover the real estate fully in like 2 minutes. You know, we have 2 minutes to two, and we want to wrap this up by two. Maybe we should save something for another time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so let's just do that and call this a wrap for now until we reconvene possibly at a later date.
Yeah, absolutely. But if I had to finish with something,
sure,
I would say don't be scared of, you know, the stock market. It does take time to get comfortable. Like anything, you need to spend some time doing your research. There's a good commercial that I've seen on TV. Basically says you spend 2 hours browsing what Netflix show you're gonna watch tonight. Why not spend 2 hours researching your future and what you're going to invest in? So, you know, go to Google, go to the iShares website. There's so many resources online. You can ask us for help, where to go, send you some links, but it's a journey, and nobody's ever going to master it, because it's always going to be evolving, because the world changes and you need to change as well. So,
And also listen to us next time we do one of these sessions. Spend that extra, you know, extra almost an hour or something. Just listen to us. I think you know, you'll find what we have to say kind of interesting, and it might just, you know, enrich your lives.
Welcome back, everyone. And that's it for our show for today. If you enjoyed Andy's and Edward's episode today, please let us know. If there's enough interest, we might see more content from them. If you would like to reach out to Andy or Edward, we have links to their bios and LinkedIn profile in our show notes and on our website. And with that, I hope you all have a great Sunday, and we'll see you again next month. Bye, everyone.